Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, the U.S. economy, the pandemic, and the presidential election. When coronavirus forced the country into lockdown last spring, businesses and whole industries were forced to shut down or scale back, and unemployment numbers went through the roof. The government stepped in with a $3 trillion stimulus, and those dollars helped sustain many individuals and companies. But now that money is running out, and daily COVID-19 cases are at an all-time high. With the presidential election on Tuesday, I asked Damian Paletta, economics editor of the Washington Post, what voters are thinking as they head to the polls. Damian, Donald Trump is touting the economic numbers that were released this week. How good are they just days before the election?
It's a great question. There's actually a lot of confusion about these numbers because the president's right. It was the best third quarter in terms of economic growth in U.S. history, but the second quarter was catastrophic. And so even though the third quarter was really strong, we're still not back, not even really that close to being back to where we were before the pandemic hit in February and March. So we've probably recovered, you know, about 60% of the lost economic growth. We've only recovered less than 60% of the lost jobs. Now, that, you know, that's one of the most important things. There's no way we'll get back to where we want to be when you still have 23 million Americans collecting unemployment benefits. So some of the economic activity is resumed. People are spending, you know, money, not as much money, but they are spending money. Some businesses have reopened. So in a sense, that's good, but we have a long way to go. And I think as we're all seeing right now, there's a real risk that we're going to be sliding in the wrong direction very soon.
It's interesting. They seem to be spending money differently now than they were before the pandemic. What are they spending money on?
I mean, it's a great question. I think, you know, we saw Amazon.com put out their earnings on Thursday and showed that they made, or they sold over $1 billion in merchandise a day, over $1 billion a day during the third quarter. I mean, people are just doing a tremendous amount of online shopping. Obviously, the big cuts in travel have, you know, there's been a little bit of a recovery, but it's still not the same, and it's not expected to be the same for several years. The airlines might not add back those routes they've cut. They've already begun cutting jobs just, I think, in the past few months again. So the travel and tourism, I think the restaurant industry obviously is still nowhere near where it was. And now we're in a situation going into the winter where a lot of these businesses that have been doing outdoor dining, you know, that's no longer going to be an option in a lot of parts of the country. So we could see a lot of restaurants going out of business in this winter as well.
So how big an impact do those two industries, the dining industry and the airline industry, how big an impact do those two combined mean for the impact of jobs?
You know, it's millions of jobs for sure in total. And I think the economy is just not going to recover when there's no travel. You know, some parts of the country, they really rely on travel. And so if people just don't feel safe, and another thing I didn't mention is commercial real estate. You know, that's another thing. You know, they could go maybe a couple months without getting their rent, or they could try to rework things here and there. But when you have all these big retailers going out of business, they're not coming back. Everyone's doing online shopping. You know, the chicken's going to kind of come home to roost soon. And what's going to happen to malls and what's going to happen to downtown areas and that kind of stuff, that still hasn't been sorted out. Because I think there was this feeling that if we just buckled down for a couple months, you know, that would kind of go back to normal, and all those outdoor lunch places that really just rely on the 9-to-5 worker, they'd all be back in business. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen anytime soon. We're really looking now into, you know, mid-2021 at the earliest. And so it's not just travel and restaurants. There's all these other things that kind of rely on people getting back to normal. And it just doesn't seem like that's going to happen anytime soon.
President Trump in the past has pointed to the stock market as being so strong and a good indicator of just how strong the economy is. Yet the other day, the stock market fell by more than 900 points. What is that telling us?
You know, it's one of the big mysteries of this whole period was this. The Dow was around 29,500 in February, the highest level ever. I think when President Trump was elected, it was around 18,000. And so, you know, within a span of a month, it fell about 9,000 points. I mean, it was unbelievable, the velocity with which it fell. Because the economy was shutting down, there was the spike in cases, the whole world was being affected. The Federal Reserve in late March took a couple steps that pumped a tremendous amount of money, and it sent a signal to Wall Street that they're really going to backstop. People didn't need to worry about the economy completely crashing. The Fed was going to be there. So that helped create this sort of K-shaped recovery, whereas the stock market recovered, big companies were able to do better. But a whole bunch of smaller companies got wiped out, and a whole bunch of workers, you know, especially people who make hourly wages, got wiped out as well. So there was this huge disconnect. And one of the tragedies of this disconnect is that it sort of sent a signal to some people in Washington, well, if the stock market's doing fine, we don't need to worry anymore. You know, everyone's going to feel like their 401k is doing fine. And now we're in a situation where we can see, as you mentioned, this all can disappear overnight. You know, it's really just numbers that are here one day and gone the next. These aren't like jobs or savings. And so just in a matter of, I think, a few weeks, we lost about 2,500 points off the Dow. It was trading around 26,000, down from 29,000 where it was September 2nd. And, you know, that's a really kind of dangerous number to pin your hopes on, because it can come and go. And it doesn't reflect the strength of the economy at all, especially, like I said, when we're talking about 23 million people collecting unemployment.
So overall, what are economists saying as they look at what's happening to the U.S. economy?
A lot of economists say it is actually remarkable the resilience that the U.S. economy has shown, particularly consumers and businesses. You know, everyone got flattened. Everyone was scared. You know, it wasn't just the virus. Everyone was worried about their savings, about paying their bills. A lot of people stopped paying their rent and their utilities. And there's still a big fight over whether people should be forced to pay their utilities. So it was tremendous that, you know, that it wasn't worse than it was. But at the same time, there's a feeling kind of on both sides, with conservatives and liberals, that we're entering a really dangerous period now. We had 90,000 new cases of the coronavirus on Thursday in the United States. You know, there's parts of the country, particularly the upper Midwest, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, places where it's actually quite frightening, the number of cases that we have and the concentration of this virus. And so I think there's a feeling that if, you know, Washington just kind of stands back and kind of is exhausted from assistance, you know, we've already pumped $3 trillion into the economy, maybe people feel like that's enough, that, you know, some bad things can happen. Now, on the other hand, you know, you can't just, as we've learned, you can't just keep spraying money at this, right? I mean, it's not a problem that can be fixed with just money. There has to be, you know, sort of new creative ways of thinking. There hasn't been a pandemic that moved this rapidly through the United States since 1918. You know, the same tools don't work. And so right now, obviously, we're in this moment right before the election where there could be, you know, a change in leadership in Congress, a change in the White House. No one kind of knows who's going to be in charge. And that could, you know, set in this sort of fear of action that, quite frankly, that we don't have that much time to be waiting, because people are really on the precipice. We saw ExxonMobil just announced they were going to cut a bunch of jobs in Texas. You know, things are happening so fast that it's not like we can wait until next year to get it all sorted out.
Here's what I don't get. The Trump administration has already said they're not going to fight the virus. They are looking for a vaccine. So could that make the difference? If a vaccine comes out, how could that affect the economy?
I think a vaccine could be probably the biggest catalyst for recovery, because it could send people back to work. It could send children back to school. You know, we've seen one of the biggest tragedies of this crisis in terms of the economy has been the impact it's had on mothers, and how many mothers have had to pull themselves out of the economy in order to, you know, take care of their children at home. So a vaccine that works, that everyone feels comfortable with, I think could have a huge impact on the economic recovery. Now, there's never been a situation where they had to get a vaccine out so quickly to so many people. And, you know, does 80% of the country, you know, willingly take the vaccine? Are people skeptical? You know, that's a whole other kind of bridge we'll have to cross as a country. But I think more than anything, more than help from the Fed, more than assistance from Congress, a vaccine that works, that has the country behind it, I think could really go a long way towards getting us back to some version of normality.
Okay, so let's go back to the Congress. You say we've spent lots of money and just pouring money into it is not going to do it. We've got to think in new and different ways. However, didn't that stimulus package at least hold off bankruptcies? Didn't it at least help people pay the rent, stay in their own homes, and do all kinds of other things? And now, as the money runs out, what's going to happen?
Well, absolutely. And I hope I didn't make my point in the wrong way. I mean, there's no doubt that the CARES Act in particular and some of the other bills that were passed, you know, they could have, quite frankly, prevented life and death. I mean, they sent $1,200 checks to more than 100 million people who were, many of them, in desperate need of assistance. Many of them could not literally afford to buy food for their families. And you also had situations where kids who were getting their only sustenance really was, you know, the free lunches at school. The school shut down. Like, there was a tremendous amount of money that went into that, and a tremendous amount of money that went to help small businesses, you know, keep paying employees, and that gave this extended unemployment insurance. I guess the point I was trying to make is you can't pass a bill to make this all go away. You can't pass a bill to make it go back to normal. I think this is kind of what we heard from the Federal Reserve initially. The Fed can cut interest rates. They can pump money into the economy. The Fed can't create a vaccine, right? So I think this, the legislation, and, you know, we did have a $3 trillion deficit last year. I mean, you know, there's a cost of all this stuff, but it did get us through to this point, you know, where there is 7.9% unemployment, but certainly that's better than 18% unemployment. You know, maybe a couple hundred thousand businesses went out of business, but that's better than 10 million businesses. So, but there's a point when, you know, the money can't solve all the problems, and they have to decide, okay, if we pass another bill that gets us through to March, can we, do we have the resources we need to kind of pivot from March with a vaccine or therapeutics or some kind of new way of running offices, you know, some new design so that we can kind of try to reopen? Or do we need to keep passing bills and giving people more money? You know, I don't unfortunately know the answer to that question, but it's scary that we're still thinking about it, you know, at this point.
So at this point, in the minds of voters who've already voted to the tune of some 82 million people, how important is the economy in their minds?
You know, I've been thinking about that a lot in the past few days, because oftentimes at the end of an election, voters really do focus on the economic proposals of the candidates. You know, a lot of these other issues fall aside, the social issues, and they really get down to, well, what is this going to mean for me and my family, me and my community, me and my school district? And I think there is going to be a piece of that. We've heard the president talking a lot about, you know, how he wants to continue cutting taxes, and he's tried to go after Vice President Biden for his tax record. But I, you know, in my heart of hearts, I feel like this coronavirus at the end of the day is going to be just an issue that the president can't avoid. And people are going to kind of judge, you know, and some people are going to say he did everything he could and it was good enough, or they're going to say he should have done more and that's how I'm casting my vote. You know, it is amazing, even though the stock market has lost several thousand points in the past few weeks, you know, it has come back from its depths in March. So maybe people do give him credit for that, for sticking with it. Or maybe people say, if they would have handled this differently, we'd be having a much different conversation and schools would be reopened and we could be kind of enjoying a recovery like some other countries are. I don't know. I mean, I think the economy is almost going to play second fiddle to the virus, but maybe the virus and the economy are just going to be inseparable for a lot of people, and it's all going to be kind of one big decision.
Many of Trump's ads and his supporters call out Joe Biden as a socialist, leading us into some kind of very different economy. What do you see in Joe Biden's economic message?
You know, it's almost kind of a traditional Democratic pitch. You know, I think, quite frankly, the socialism label comes out every presidential election from the Republicans. I mean, obviously, they tried to use it with President Obama. They've used it on many different candidates. So I almost feel like it might be losing a little bit of its sting. You know, I think what we're seeing, what Vice President Biden would bring is much different than what Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren has proposed. It's definitely kind of a progressive vision of the economy. It would make changes to the 2017 tax cuts to raise corporate tax rates, not to where they were at 35% before, but, you know, around 28%, and to use some of that new income, new revenue to, you know, invest in social programs. There would certainly be some changes to healthcare policy that I think, you know, would be a big focus of 2021 if Biden wins. And also, you know, I think there'd be a lot more kind of favorable environment for labor unions, you know, a lot of reversals of what we've seen under the Trump administration. So I think it would be kind of almost a traditional thing. You know, Biden keeps talking about his roots in Delaware and Scranton. Those are kind of, you know, working class blue collar areas that he, you know, kind of prides himself on. And so I think we'd see, you know, a lot more focus on that. One thing, though, that I think would be interesting would be where he comes down on trade, because I feel like the Democratic Party has moved. And it's funny, the lines have been blurred. President Trump's views on trade kind of align with a lot of what the Democrats believe, you know, that we should be a little bit more aggressive, that there should be more fighting for the American worker in manufacturing. So I think that would be kind of an interesting thing to watch, to see if Biden has a different approach than President Obama did on trade. But quite frankly, that might take, if Biden wins, it might take a year or two to sort of play out, because the focus initially, I would think, depending on if either candidate wins, is going to be sort of a tremendous economic response to try to prevent this crisis from getting worse.
On the other hand, both candidates have certainly campaigned an awful lot in Michigan and talked about bringing manufacturing jobs back to Michigan. President Trump promised that 4 years ago. How well did he keep that promise?
I think he made a big push, and we saw some of the actions he took, you know, especially with like steel and aluminum tariffs and some of these other tariffs to try to make it costly for foreign imports to come to the U.S. But I think in the grand scheme of things, it really didn't work out the way that he had kind of promised. You know, we had a story in the Post recently about, I think just a few days after President Trump won the election, he went to Indiana to try to, you know, kind of strong arm Carrier into keeping jobs and not moving them to Mexico. And they had this big announcement, and there was a photo opportunity, and Carrier did announce that it was going to not send all the jobs it thought it would to Mexico, but it would send some. And sure enough, 4 years later, the company's, you know, no longer the same company it was. And a lot of jobs, not just from Carrier, but from other companies in Indiana, ended up going overseas. I mean, I think this is one area that Democrats and Republicans have talked about for years, bringing these manufacturing jobs back to the U.S. But just the economic forces are so tremendous, you know, in the wrong direction for that. It's just so difficult to reverse that. Vice President Biden has talked about this too, creating some kind of incentives for companies to manufacture things in the United States. You know, it's very similar kind of to what President Trump has tried to do. It's just incredibly difficult. It makes, you know, good campaign fodder, but it's so hard to bend these economic forces.
More of my conversation with Damian Paletta when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Damian Paletta. He's economics editor at the Washington Post. Joe Biden has promised to raise taxes on people earning more than $400,000 a year. Trump has said bluntly, Joe Biden is going to raise all your taxes. There's a big difference between 400,000 earners and everybody else. First of all, how successful would a tax increase on those earning more than $400,000 be?
It's a great question. And we've actually talked about this a lot on the economics team at The Post because, you know, it's very hard to raise taxes in the middle of a recession, right? I mean, it can help pay for things, but it doesn't necessarily stimulate more economic activity initially during a downturn. So there will be, I would imagine, if Biden wins, a lot of pressure on him to delay a tax increase until the economy has regained its footing, because he's probably going to be doing whatever he can to try to stimulate economic growth, whether that's tax cuts or, you know, whatever he needs to do, more spending, infrastructure, that kind of thing. Now, in terms of, you know, whether he could successfully increase taxes, you know, we are talking about, like I said, a $3 trillion deficit. I think there's a sense probably in both parties that fiscally the House isn't in order. And so, you know, maybe they do have a big confab about what to do about that, if they need to make some adjustments on spending and make some adjustments on revenue to get that sorted out. But it's always much easier in Washington to cut taxes and increase spending than the other way around. And so, you know, how he would do that, it would be tough. But I think it's one of those things, it's hard to imagine the first item he'd want to do if he had this political goodwill would be come out of the gate and raise taxes.
Well, conversely, how successful were the tax cuts that Trump put in place immediately after he was elected?
It's a great question. I've actually studied this quite closely. So the tax cut law was passed in December 2017. And in March 2018, you know, we all know what happened. This incredible trade war began between the United States and several other countries. Now, this trade war had the tax cuts were supposed to stimulate all this economic activity. And there was a, you know, a fair amount of economic activity in 2018. It never quite got to the huge growth levels that President Trump had promised, but the economy did grow. But this threat and, quite frankly, all these new tariffs led businesses to pull back their investment. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know what was going to happen. So you had all these businesses stop kind of spending and investing and research and stuff like that. And that kind of, you know, cost the economy a lot of the potential benefit of the tax cuts. So what we ended up getting in 2018 and in 2019 was, you know, nearly $1 trillion deficit because the revenues really didn't come in, but the spending stayed really high. And we never really got the growth that I think we were projected to get. And then sure enough, in 2020, the pandemic hits. There's even less revenue than projected, and the spending kind of goes through the roof. And so it's going to be impossible to ever have that law live up to its expectations or promises, because we lost so much ground in 2020 that it could take a decade to sort of get back to the revenue levels that they had projected it to ever get to. And who knows between now and then what other changes there might be.
So if Trump is reelected, what do you see him doing economically while not focusing on the pandemic?
Well, he's talked and talked about a payroll tax cut. And actually, he's talked about eliminating the payroll tax, potentially. And, you know, he's really gotten a cold shoulder from both Democrats and Republicans in Congress on this. But if he wins re-election, I think it might be the kind of thing where they say, okay, fine, he won. Maybe, you know, voters think this is what they want to do, and we'll do it. Now, remember, the payroll tax is something that people pay that funds Social Security,
exactly.
Right? So, yeah, that money's, you know, it gets used. And so they'd have to find some other way to finance Social Security, or else Social Security would run out of money, and that would be a huge, you know, problem both economically and politically. So, you know, what he's talked about is another big stimulus package in the range of $1.5 to $2 trillion. He loves those $1,200 checks, more small business assistance. You know, he's really been on a campaign of deregulation in his first term. I expect that would continue if he's reelected. You know, he hasn't been that precise about what his second term agenda would be, but it essentially, he promises to get the economy back to where it was in February 2020 before the pandemic. You know, low taxes, deregulation, you know, spending levels that are high for, you know, for Republican presidents and Republican proposals. And to sort of see if the economy can get this exit velocity that it's been, you know, kind of lacking, quite frankly, since the financial crisis in 2008.
But even if, let's just imagine, he had the same Congress he's got now.
Right.
How supportive would that Congress be of that kind of spending, considering the kinds of deficit we're seeing?
I think that each president usually gets one kind of free pass right after their election. You know, for President Obama, there was the stimulus bill that was passed, you know, really early in 2009. And then he had to really fight, obviously, for the healthcare law and for Dodd-Frank. Those stretched into 2010. President Trump tried to front load his healthcare law, and it kind of, you know, didn't work out. And then they had to scramble and do the tax law at the end of 2017. So I think if President Trump wins, he would get one bill that both parties would kind of get behind him on. Now, he might have to give some, if Democrats retain the House, he might have to give them something in exchange for that, whether it's a minimum wage increase or something like that. But I imagine that if he wins, there'll be an opportunity for him to get something through that kind of nods to his agenda.
Of course, that all depends on how that Congress looks after next Tuesday.
Exactly.
So do we have any idea, Damien, how the president's economic message is playing out in battleground states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan?
You know, when I watched the last debate and saw Vice President Biden make the comments at the end about oil, I thought, well, here we have an issue that is separate from the virus that really could strike a nerve with people. And, you know,
especially younger people.
Right. But it also people kind of from energy-dependent areas of Pennsylvania. You know, it could strike a nerve on both sides. And so I was kind of watching to see what would happen, and it seemed like the Biden campaign was trying to quickly kind of backpedal a little bit, and President Trump was really trying to go on offense. And then, you know, Diane, 2 days later, I feel like it all disappeared. I mean, I truly feel like when you have such a huge surge in coronavirus cases in Wisconsin and parts of the upper Midwest, that kind of just washes everything else away. And because it really has an impact, it really affects the economy. You know, we're seeing in parts of Europe, they're beginning another set of shutdowns. Disneyland in Paris is shut down indefinitely. You know, Spain and the UK are shutting down. I don't know if there's the political will to do that here, but we're seeing pockets of United States. I know El Paso just had a huge surge in cases and was trying to figure out what to do because their hospitals are full. I think there's issues like health that can just overwhelm everything else. And, you know, even a debate about tax policy, which is, you know, the United States has been debating since before it was founded, right? Even issues like that can take a back seat to, you know, a pandemic. And that might be what we're seeing in the final days of this.
Damien, there's been lots of talk about a K-shaped recovery. Explain to me and our listeners what that means.
Sure. So it's funny, we've used almost all the letters of the alphabet, but the K seems to be the one that's sticking. Initially, President Trump said there was going to be a V-shaped recovery, with the idea being that we were going to come down quickly and then go right back up, you know, very quickly, right to where we were. And then there was the idea of a W-shaped recovery, which could be kind of a double-dip recession, right? We come back, and then we go back down, and then we come back up. The idea of a K-shaped recovery, which, you know, Fed Governor Lael Brainard has mentioned, you know, and she's a possible pick for Biden's Treasury Secretary, so she's someone to be watching very closely. The idea of a K-shaped recovery is that we sort of start at the same point on the line of the K, and then half of us go up, and half of us go down. And so there's going to be people that have money in the stock market. There's going to be businesses that, you know, specialize in online retail or, you know, takeout at restaurants or whatever that actually can do quite well at this. But there's going to be a whole lot of people going in the wrong direction. And it's going to be hard. You know, obviously it creates a tremendous amount of income inequality. It can fuel populism. It's not a way to live, quite frankly, when you've got so many people getting, you know, separated from the rest. It creates tremendous amount of problems in school when you have low-income children who don't have access to computers and don't have access to FaceTime with teachers and anything like that. It can, you know, this can be a legacy crisis for a lot of people. And I think that's the big concern right now, is that the people that are on the kind of wrong end of the K don't get the help they need when they need it most.
So does Trump talk about a K-shaped recovery at all?
The only letter I've heard from him is V. He's even mentioned, I think, an I-shaped recovery once, which is, you know, straight up and down. But no, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see if he wins, to see if his rhetoric changes a little bit. You know, he's obviously trying to really promote the economy heading into the final days. He wants Americans to feel like it's a tremendous accomplishment of how far we've come since the really terrible days of March and April when we lost, you know, over 20 million jobs. But if he is reelected and he, you know, has to fix this, he might need to have a sober conversation with the country about kind of the long haul and how hard this is going to be, and how there are a lot of people. I mean, we've seen some of his aides, quite frankly, Larry Kudlow, the director of the National Economic Council, has said that there's a lot of people who are in really tough situations. And so I think, you know, if the president wins reelection, that's a conversation that he could be having with the country relatively soon. You know, happy talk doesn't solve all problems. And I think he's going to want, if he wins, he'll want his economic legacy to be a strong one. And so that's something that he's going to want to have to address and need to address.
So whatever happens next Tuesday in the election, do you think we'll see another stimulus package next year?
I do. I actually do. You know, the question is, will we see one in the lame duck session of Congress? Because there might be a feeling on both sides that we simply can't wait 2.5 months. You know, if all these restaurants do have to pull in the tables for the winter, and if people simply can't, you know, avoid not paying their utilities anymore, and they're making tough choices, and the travel industry never recovers, it's a long way between November 3rd and January 20th.
Yeah.
And so the question is Washington going to be kind of paralyzed? And if we don't know the outcome of the election, or we don't know who controls the Senate, it's going to be much harder for them to do anything. But, you know, those are going to be a long 10 weeks for the country, and especially if the coronavirus is still raging. And so they might have to do a couple stimulus bills in the interim.
Damian, is there anything else I should be asking you, or anything else you want to say?
Diane, the last time we talked, I think, was in April. And, you know, it was a really scary time for the country. There was so much uncertainty. You know, in April, like I said, we lost 20 million jobs in a month, almost a million a day, which is tremendous. But at the time that we spoke, I think there were around 18,000 deaths. And to think how many people have died since then in just 6 months, you know, it's astounding. And, you know, the stock market will come back. We could have an identical number to what we had in February, but this country will never be the same. You know, so many lives are going to be changed forever. And it's something that we're all going to have to get through together in terms of putting this economy back together. But we have to sort of acknowledge that we'll never be the same country we were before. And, you know, maybe that's just me being home for too long and thinking about this too much, but it's something that we have to be sort of in agreement about as a country. This is a different experience. We've gone through something that, you know, like the great influenza, almost like the Vietnam War, which everything's kind of different at the end than it was at the beginning.
What is the biggest change we're likely to see going forward?
I mean, are there going to be people that'll pack into a movie theater again? Are there going to be people that go to crowded restaurants and crowded bars? Are there going to be people that travel home for Thanksgiving? Are there going to be people who just feel comfortable out in society? Are there going to be people that feel comfortable shaking hands with strangers? Are there going to be people who exchange hugs the way they did? Are there going to be people who feel comfortable sending their kids to college the way they did? Are there going to be people who feel comfortable maxing out their credit cards and kind of, you know, living paycheck to paycheck? I mean, it can affect so many things. Our appetite for risk, our appetite for danger, our appetite for travel, all that could be different. And if some people feel comfortable and they're ready to bust loose, and trust me, like, I'm, you know, as ready as anybody for this to all be over. But psychologically, are we going to be the same country as that we were in February? You know, I don't think we will be. And I don't know what we will be, but it won't be the same.
Damian, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Damian Paletta, economics editor at The Washington Post. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've reached out to let me know what you'd like me to cover during these very difficult times. Please continue to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening, all. I sure hope you're going to get out there and vote in person on Tuesday or in a Dropbox between now and then. I'm Diane Rehm.